Growing up in sports, you get to know people and you go, oh, well, he's no different. He's got a different know people and their cultures, and it's the way you interact. I mean, if the one thing you have in common is, okay, here's our common ground. We have certain rules and regulations we have to do for long-term success. I don't mean rules, it's the way we treat each other. And all the other stuff is kind of, you learn it as you go, but you've still got the business transaction. And it is the way that you can go talk to somebody in Japan, Russia, I don't know about Russia, you know, Africa, it's the common thing, trade. It happens everywhere.
Yeah. Okay. Other thoughts? Anybody?
It's so obvious because it actually is where most of our friendships take place these days, too. So it used to be back when I was growing up in the 50s, you know, mothers were left at home with the children, and they had coffee with one another, and they got to know each other. And then you had the Bible studies grow up, you know, the women's Bible studies around coffees in neighborhoods. Well, now women are having coffee break at work because so many are working. And it's changed the way we relate to one another. And it is the main place we relate to one another aside from, you know, church or other groups.
Mm-hmm.
And so I spend more time with my business partner and my clients than I do with anybody in my neighborhood.
Yeah. The tracking statistic in this chapter, 88,000 hours, is the estimated number of hours that you will spend on average at work.
In a lifetime.
In your lifetime. 88,000 hours.
I would venture to say, too, it is actually the feminization, the true feminization, I think, of the work culture that actually is bringing about this renewed interest in the integration of work and faith. It's much easier for men to dichotomize what they're doing, I think, than women. And women want integrity, relational integrity at work, in their relationships and in what they do every day. And so that has brought about a wholesale change in how the marketplace sees themselves.
Scott, the other thing that is obvious, maybe again one of these obvious things, but you can be in a neighborhood, you know, if you want to say, well, maybe it's the neighborhoods. Well, you can be in a neighborhood, but you can pick the neighbors that you want to be involved with. You can be in a church, but you can also pick the people that you, okay? You don't get that option in the workplace, okay? You're forced to work with people you like or don't like or who have a variety of different backgrounds, whether it's a team or a department you're in or whatever, however it comes about. So now the issue is how does Christianity manifest itself when you don't get to pick, okay, when it's not easy. And I think that's why it's a great mission field for that reason. Tom?
I think the other thing is that there's many countries where missionaries can't go, but business people are accepted. Mm-hmm. And business people will be accepted doing quasi-missions work as long as they're contributing to that particular that culture, society, etc. So I think it's from a strategy point of view, I think a lot of people are thinking about this. It is a way to get entry into countries, not just tent-making. I was talking more about people going in with organizations and working in countries and being able to do ministry and have it accepted, where even as a mission organization, you probably wouldn't get in.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated to read about the Chi's letter where they, you know, leave out the word.
That wasn't Kathy Chi, if you don't know. They're a couple of long time Redeemer family who are now from China. He's a medical doctor. Three kids, four kids, something like that. Yeah. Well, I thought about this Tom Henry that you and I met a few weeks ago, who's working with the Underground Church in China, but also has a vision for working, I should say, with business, primarily it's business men in China, but a vision for working with non-Christian Chinese business people as an opportunity to present the gospel ultimately to them. Look at the second question, please. One of the big questions of Chapter 5 is twofold. Is the marketplace a place where mission work can be undertaken? That's one of the questions. Is the marketplace a place where mission work can be undertaken? And is marketplace activity itself a part of God's mission in the world. And this is what I'd like to, let's frame this chapter a little bit. Let me take a stab at this, and you all can tell me whether you think I'm on base or off base here. But if we, that's not going to work. Let's see if there's a, pardon?
What?
You think I can make this from here? Oh, so close. This looks like, that's not going to work. We have anything that's a color that we can actually. Well, how does this yellow work? Let's try this. I don't want to. That's not going to work, is it?
Can you
I'm not great with colors anyway. My granddaughter and I were watercoloring a few days ago, and
I'd say, no, is that purple or blue?
Purple.
Let's see if this works. Okay, here we go. We're in business. Let's start with a major heading, Kingdom Ministry / Mission. And I want to divide this right down the middle, so sort of. And I want to talk about it, and I think this chapter talks about it, as being Kingdom Ministry at work versus Kingdom Ministry in work. And this has kind of been something that Stephen has hit on all along anyway, but let's talk, first of all, what's the difference? What's he getting at here? Kingdom ministry at work versus kingdom ministry in work. Randy, what are you thinking?
I agree with the chapter. I would say in work just means in what we're doing, and at work means where we are.
Yeah.
And the, not necessarily the people we're involved with, but just showing up.
Yeah. Let's tease out some more from this. What are you thinking, Eric? Elisa, what are you thinking?
Right. So the at work in terms of dealing with the coworkers and clients, people you were involved with, actually ministering to the people that are there. And then in work, the idea that it would be more of the work that you are doing and how you are ministering through your work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Others?
Rob, I was thinking about in terms of the Christ and culture paradigm overall, and at work says, okay, there's this physical reality of work, and that doesn't have to do much with spiritual things. And so we use that as a platform for being relational, which is actually the spiritual thing. And so that's how I look at that. And in work actually looks at the physical thing and says there's actually value-driven stuff in that.
Yeah, he's hitting on this old idea. This is not exactly this, but this will capture. Is there intrinsic value for a believer in work, in your work? You know, if that's not kind of directly gospel-related, is there intrinsic value in the work? Or is work, does it simply have for you as a believer extrinsic value? You take the money that you earn and you use it for God's kingdom. And so the question he's asking, the version of that question that he's asking here is there value for the believer in the work itself, in what you do, that contributes to the kingdom? I mean, he would say it as specifically as that. Is there value in the work for the kingdom of Christ in terms of kingdom ministry, kingdom mission? Versus is there value, well, I think we'd say, yeah, there, when you're at work, is there an opportunity to view that work as a mission field in the more traditional sense? So looking for opportunities to actually preach the gospel. Tom?
I would say in work is just the intrinsic value of work. If you think of the command to God to subdue the world. And that implies the use of applied technology. It implies making things that could be of value to society. Mm-hmm. It implies doing things well, bringing joy, happiness to whatever you're doing. So I think there really is value in the work, the product you make or the service you sell or how you go about doing your work. I think it's great.
Yeah, I think... Now I've lost my balloon. There it is. So cool. I think the what you remind me of, Tom, as you mentioned that, is... This would fall, and I don't want to draw too hard a line between these, but at work would fall under kind of a great commission mandate, whereas this would fall under the what we typically call the creation mandate. So that's kind of what he's hitting on here in this chapter is there, he doesn't want to, and he rails against a model that says for Christians, the work itself is not meaningful. He's done that from chapter 1, and now chapter 5 he's doing the same thing in terms of thinking about your marketplace, wherever that marketplace is, as a mission field.
But where did we get from, and I agree with this, I've just always wondered, where do we get from work as part of the punishment? You're thrown out of the garden, you're going to toil, you're going to battle the thorns, you're going to have pain in childbirth, and you're going to die.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I mean, it was kind of part of that punishment.
Yep.
All of a sudden, it is a major, goes from a negative major factor in life to this is one of the most important parts of your life. And I never saw that transition. It's just like all of a sudden.
It's there. It's just there.
Yeah.
Tom, are you thinking of responding to this question? Or
yeah, I'm just scratching here because I teach on this a lot when I do early Genesis work. And because I wrestled with it as well. We see in the garden before the fall them working. So it wasn't that work came out of the fall. Work was there before the fall. The toil and the trouble of work came after the fall and the difficulty of it. That's when thorns of the grow. It would make things more difficult. So,
perfect.
So I think.
See it if you don't see it.
Huh?
Perfect if you don't see it.
Yeah, right.
This term, right?
Yeah. So, but that's, we say work was a good thing and was actually mandated by God before the fall. You're going to care for the garden. So work didn't come about as a result of the fall, but work was like everything, seriously tainted by the fall.
So we went from work as part of the creative process to toil, and how did we get back to work?
Well, I mean,
some days my job is just toil.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's a reflection of the fall, and I don't think Stevens is saying, and I'm not saying that, if we're in the right place spiritually, that our work will always be, what God intended it to be in the garden, because at least in this world, I don't think it will be because of the fall. So. It's not either or, it's both. That it is a good thing because it's reflective of what God did when he created us. It's got a lot of bad baggage attached to it because of the fall, because we bring our sin into our marketplace, into our world. So it's both. Anybody else?
Rob? I think with what you're saying, Cliff, people tend to separate these out and say one is spiritual, one is physical, and think about it in those terms. But if you start to think about both of them being spiritual and physical, there's things that you do, redemptive things that you can do to bring the creation back to its proper place and put it in proper order. So, like, for instance, if you're in a manufacturing process and you're polluting as part of that process, just saying, the earth's going to pass away, there's no foundation for it for the kingdom to come, there's no mandate for actually caring for physical creation as well. That's a bad way to look at it, rather than saying, there's opportunities in the waste stream, I'm going to collect things, I'm going to clean things up, I'm going to actually steward things for the following generation. So there's a spiritual stuff and Great Commission stuff in the physical reality around us, not just the relational things. So, and I think a lot of authors are starting to see that now and talk about how creation is falling and we're involved in the redemption of the broader creation as well.
He says here, let me put this up in this chapter, he makes this point. He says, this piece of kingdom ministry at work builds the faith community. Whereas this piece builds the human community. What do you think of that? He's saying this Great Commission mandate that we have and that we take into our marketplace, so we're going in intentionally to attempt to preach the gospel, that builds the faith community. mandate that says work, the work itself is good, and Rob, this touches on the point you just made, that builds a human community. Now, I'm not sure I'm completely on board with this division. At least, I'm not on board with drawing a hard line here, because I think what we do in our work can actually, you know, it's not an excuse for not preaching the gospel verbally, but I don't want to say that it cannot. And probably Stevens wouldn't say that either, but he does make the point, and it is kind of a nice way to think about the at-work versus the in-work, you know, that we are, we do have two purposes. We're building the faith community, and we are building the human community. Thoughts on that?
You mentioned Tom Henry. He gave me a book when he was here. It was a series of articles about this issue. And basically what people in missions have found, and people have studied it, is that if you are, in the case of going into a country to start a business as a ministry, that you have to have the same heart of the missionary. You've got to have, you've got to go through the same, have the same perspective. At the same time, you have to say this business, it's got to make a profit. It's got to be successful. It's got to be run well. It's got to be ethical. It's got to have all of these things. So, you know, I think they're so connected. It's hard to draw the line. You know. And then, like, apparently, what they found is that, you know, people go with it, you know, from a missions perspective as tent makers, but are not good at running a business, that ends up being a failure most of the time. Conversely, if someone goes with the skills to operate a business that has the heart of missions and a series of other things that, you know, need to be done, obviously, but that seems to be the thing that works. And I think, it, you know, we go to work down the street, the same thing would apply.
Beverly, you want to say something?
I've heard sermons that say, you know, the Great Commission says, translated, as you are going into all the world, preach the gospel. And to me, that seems what this is, you know, it really just goes back to wherever we are and in every part of what we do. I'm not a big traveler, I'm not a big mission trip person, but I went on a mission trip last fall, and it was the whole purpose of this mission is to teach business in third world countries. And we were in Ukraine, and we were, the module I was helping with was the HR module. And things that we take for granted because we are so steeped in Judeo-Christian philosophy is very very different and out on the edge to them in terms of ethics and doing things the right way, and, you know, the idea even of doing unto others as you would have others do unto them, to you, is a foreign concept. And so it might be hard for us to think about how much impact that being salt and light really does have in this country and then when we go to other countries. It isn't always about the exact words. It's about being salt and light,
yeah,
wherever we are, as we're going. I don't know.
Yeah. Other thoughts?
Yeah. In one of the articles that's up there, Stevens actually advocates a tiered approach to this, so that one of the things that we can call the non-Christian to the creation mandate to help build the community because of their human. And, you know, there's value in what they do. And so that's sort of the baseline. This gets back to, I guess, the discussion 2 weeks ago where we had the tiered approach where you do your job, you do it well, that type of thing. And then, you know, it actually takes somebody who has faith to call other people to faith. And so, you know, as Christians, we should be doing the creation mandate really, really well so we can call people to it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the at-work stuff builds upon.
Yeah. Let me just list out of this chapter a few bullet points, and I want to label this, even though this is not the way it's, but the why and how. And I just want to answer that with some bullet points. Let me just put these up, and then I'd like to talk about them a little bit. And these are just, you'll find these somewhere in this chapter. One of the whys and hows is access. The second is relational context. The third is simply, he calls it, he just says sheer time. The fourth is intrinsic issues, values. The sixth is life centeredness. And the seventh is proximity to people in need / crisis. So, again, thinking about this side where we're actually going purposefully into our work environment looking for opportunities to verbally communicate the gospel. And he says, here is what provides that opportunity. Here's what should provide that opportunity. Access, a relational context, sheer time, this 88,000 hours that we talked about a few minutes ago, intrinsic issues, values, life-centeredness, proximity to people in need, crisis. Now, first of all, I just want to ask, any clarity needed on any of those? Because the next question would be, I'll tell you what the next question would be in just a moment, but access, you know, he makes the point that in a lot of work environments, you have to, you're key carded out unless you are part of the work community there. And so you have access to people that others don't. Relational context, you do have, in a sense, and we talked about this a few minutes ago, a shared life. You share certain things as a member of a work community. Sheer time, we talked about intrinsic issues and values. You know, he makes the point the marketplace itself raises issues that are openings for the gospel and pastoral care, issues of identity, relationality, priorities, credibility, life purpose, etc. Life-centeredness, you know, people looking at your life in ways that make it winsome to them. And so that opens the door for communication of the gospel. And then, you know, you're rubbing up against people who have needs, who are sometimes in crisis. And he makes the point in the chapter that for a lot of people, they go to you as a workmate before they go to a pastor. A lot of people don't have a pastor of some sort to turn to. Thoughts on that? Here's my next question. I think I've actually got this. This is question four, I believe. As you think about your marketplace, do specific examples come to mind where you've been provided an opportunity to share your faith? As you think about these specific areas, can you think of experiences, either your own experience or maybe something you've heard of in somebody else's life, where a door to present the gospel has been opened through one of these opportunity sets?
Yeah, I can. Yeah. I work in advertising, which is a very interesting field, not necessarily just because of the work we do, but I think it tends to draw people who are, just in my experience, I've worked at four agencies who are, you know, they're highly educated, highly creative. Many of them don't believe in God, who I've worked with at least. It's a bit of a mockery about Christians, as well as some other religions, but so it's an interesting field to work in for all those reasons. And I was walking by specifically, what was coming to mind as you were asking that question, is I was walking across our lobby one day, and the guy who was in charge of our IT at the time was talking to our receptionist. And I didn't know what they were talking about. And she says, she looks up and sees me coming, and she says, "Oh, good, David's coming. You should ask David that question." And I was like, I don't know what questions he's going to be asking me. And so I walked up and I was like, "Hey, what's up?" And she, we know each other fairly well, not that well, but she knew I was a Christian, and I knew she was a Christian. And so he says, what did he say? He said something like, so if God is, so if there's a God, and I was like, oh. So if there is a God, why do bad things continue happening to poor people and great things happen.
Why does Haiti happen?
Right. So we had a great conversation for, I stood there for 45 minutes. No, I'm just kidding. But we stood there for 45 minutes, and it's funny because the guy who works for the IT guy ended up walking by and stopping and listening to the conversation. And then other people, there ended up being like six people standing around talking about it. In an advertising agency, talking about, you know, God. And you know, I just, the life-centeredness, I guess because she recognized me as a Christian and saw me coming. And I don't know what they've been talking about before, so I don't know how she had answered the question or if she felt a little taken aback. But she, you know, I was glad to be walking by at that moment. And it was cool. And so we ended up out of that conversation. We ended up actually, he and I and her and about six other people got together every Tuesday at lunch just to talk about just kind of like bigger issues. And like one Tuesday we talked about evolution. And so it opened a really interesting opportunity.
So where would you put that? I mean, what was the impetus if you had to peg it on this? What gave you that opportunity? Kind of the right place at the right time on it, but there was...
Yeah, I was going to...
I mean, it was your friend basically knowing that you were a believer, so yeah. How did that come? I mean, your co-worker that knew that, so how did that come about?
I don't know. I'd like to think maybe I look a little different than... Not look. But I look a little different than... I mean, I've described, not to overgeneralize, but I've described the typical advertising creative person earlier, and... you know, like I try to do things subtly sometimes. So like I have a shirt that says worship in Hebrew, and underneath it says worship, and I wear that to work. And
okay.
You know, little things like that. Or
okay.
Maybe in conversation, just mention something about you know, a conference that I went to or a book I'm reading.
Yeah.
Without being over the top, but enough to so that people know where I stand on things.
Others, thanks, sir. Tom.
I think the last one, proximity, just in the last few years, actually of late, you know, when someone's going to have a baby or something like that here, we line up meals for them. And it dawned on me, it was like, why not seize that opportunity when one of our colleagues either moves or we have one who's going to have a baby here soon and is like three blocks away from where I live. So, you know, Andrew, yeah. So I said, you know, look, are you vegetarian or meat people? Because, you know, I'll be bringing a meal sometime after, you know, when you have the baby in a couple weeks. And she, not ever having a good conversation before, all of a sudden, the barriers were gone. And so, you know, and then she started asking about a couple different things. And so I think just taking those kind of opportunities in that vein for doing really simple things like that, which we know are important here within the church.
Other examples come to mind as you're thinking about this?
I see. You get maybe healthy. I travel a lot to China. I just got back. And it's their Lunar New Year. And that's a big thing. It's Christmas. Thanksgiving all rolled into one big holiday over there, so they call it the spring festival. So anyway, I came home Tuesday night, or actually Wednesday morning, but I was sitting in the hotel at the airport on Tuesday night, and I was thinking, what could I write for college there? And two of the three of them, I was writing, do speak English. I don't speak any Mandarin. My vocabulary is about three words. It used to be something different after I said. Anyway, they're very concerned about their environment, which is, as you know, it's horrible. So I was trying to think, what can I say to these people that they would have any context or whatever. So anyway, I said certain things at the tail end. I know they'd like to be concerned about their environment. So I said something like, what did I say? I said, care for creation and be in awe of the Creator. So I know that's gonna bring some questions when I get back. So I'm going to think of how can you relate to people who have, you mentioned the Bible, these people don't have a clue. Or, you know, about religion or
And one of the key guys I work with is a party member, and I know. So it's different. But the context, I would say, is, been able to build a relationship, spend a lot of time with them, got access, but very limited and verbal communication. So how do you work that problem out? That's a struggle that I'm trying to figure out. How do I make use of my time with it that can make a difference?
You got to answer that question?
No.
I have no idea.
I have a brain that would speak
Mandarin. No, but I mean, what that's doing, that's taking steps towards core problems, calling them to the baseline creation mandate, but they should be concerned about their environment. But they're not, because their worldview, is at odds with that. And maybe shouldn't be.
I want to touch it, having grown up in Hong Kong.
Okay.
I think underneath language and underneath all of these issues, people who are not in Christ are devalued. Mm-hmm. They're devalued by their culture, by their family, by their business. At some level, they're always devalued. And so any move that we make inside of language or outside that puts value into that person will be responded to with surprise. Whether they react positively or negatively to that, it'll begin the process of breaking down barriers, whatever that valuing ends up looking like, whether it's time, gifts in Asian culture, whatever it is.
I think that's an important thing to think about also, though, if we work here in the United States. I'm a first grade teacher, and I think one of the most important things I can do is to have my students know that I care and that they are important to me. I see teachers that don't always exhibit that. That's my goal. I probably don't always either, but that's my goal. That I want them to know that they are valued. So I think even wherever we are, I think that's what.
I actually have a quick, very specific example. When I was studying Arabic in Monterey, one of the girls there, a young Air Force officer, she had been completely devalued by her family, and she would get text messages during class, from her mother, "I can't believe you were so stupid and spent your money that way," things like this. And one day during break, she just began to break down. And I said to her, "I want you to understand that the king of the universe died for you. You're the most expensive thing. God never spent money on anything. He never bought anything. But he paid for you." Mm-hmm. And I don't think she was a Christian. I know she had a little Catholic background. But that's still true. It's still true for her. And to communicate the idea that the king of the universe died to take you in and rescue you, whether you accept it or not.
Rob, you were going to go a different direction.
I was going to say, too, in relationship to what Tom was talking about, part of the communist mindset is, as long as the society as a whole is progressing, the people as a whole are progressing, that, what happens to one individual, that they would get cancer or pollution would affect them, it's really no big deal because the whole society is moving. And this is where it comes into conflict with the gospel, because there really is individual value in the gospel that the Chinese really don't necessarily see or have. I think they probably have a better grasp of community than we do in the West. But, anytime we can speak into that specific thing, I think this also comes into play with there's a lot of cultural push now around copyright and patent infringement in China. And so you hear about that a lot in the news. And that comes down to what is the value of an individual's work and what right do they have to it versus the society. And so that's, a value interplay that's happening in commerce that has its roots in kind of these cultural value-laden issues that we can speak into. With them, because that's where we find ourselves in conflict. Related to that, I have a story about
myself as a young engineer, 2 years out of school, I was told, copy all these specs for this power plant. And they had copyrights on them. It was done by a competing firm. I said, I can't do this. I can't do this. I just can't copy this carte blanche. I said, I will stay after work, and I will delve into these things, understand them, and rewrite them in a different kind of way, because this thing is copyrighted, and that's illegal. And so that caused, you know, me to get a reputation for a guy that was fairly ethical, but also would do things on his own time. And so that provided a way for me to talk with my bosses, with other peers, about my own fate, because I just said, no, I'm not going to do this. And I actually had some of my richest conversations about fate came out of that as a young engineer. Just where I said, you know, I just can't do this. Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about this intrinsic issues and values. And let me say, I told you the very first day that one reason I want to teach this is because I'm not good at a lot of what is in here. So I'm not setting myself up. But there's one good example that I'd like to share with you. One of my best friends in the world is actually a colleague. And some of you may know, Tom, you might guess who this is by the time I'm done. So I would ask you not to tell that person that I'm waving this flag. But this person and I have, in terms of intrinsic issues and values, we have a common interest in barbecue. And that leads us to get in the car and drive for hours. We don't do it so much these days, but when we were first friends 15, 20 years ago, we'd get in the car and drive to Memphis. And, well, that gives you a lot of face time, right? So we got to know each other very well. And I don't even know how this began, but say 15 years ago, we had some really intense conversations around Christianity. Intense and frank to the point that, you know, at one point in the conversation, we both laugh about this at this point. I mean, it's not funny, but we look back on it, that he said to me, you wouldn't really say I was a Christian, would you? I mean, he had revealed enough about what he believed, and I said, no, I wouldn't. And to this point, he'll raise that now and then with me. Well, we had them over, he and his significant other, over for dinner Friday night, not intending anything, but, you know, I'd smoked some beef ribs, so we were just going to enjoy some meat and some red meat. And I can't even tell you how the conversation turned to this, but this is the first time, and I think it's something that he actually said, sitting around the dinner table after we'd eaten and we're kind of drinking coffee and having dessert, and the conversation turned the corner to Christianity again. And we had, for the first time in about 15 years, we had a really intense hour-plus conversation around these same issues. And so I say that to say, you know, here you've got a value that's kind of a humorous value, but it is something that connects us. And you've got this long time period that has passed, 15 years. I pray for this guy pretty much every day and tend to avoid, for the most part, I said at the end of this last Friday night, I said, you know, we both tend to kind of dance around these issues most of the time because we know we're going to end up in a, it wasn't a shouting match or anything like that, but it was very intense and very candid. But it was really, I hope that's encouraging to you that, you know, after 15 years, I was thinking about Abraham and Sarah. Oh, I was thinking about Zechariah and Elizabeth. And, you know, Zechariah goes into the temple doing his job. He's this old guy. I mean, old geezer. His wife is old as well. And what did the angel say to him? I mean, after kind of calming him down a little bit because he's just seen an angel. What did the angel say? Your prayer has been answered. I found myself wondering the last time I read that, how long had it been since he'd given up on that prayer? I mean, he didn't believe that his wife could ever bear a child because they were both old. And so I wondered, how long had it been? And maybe he was still praying. I don't know the answer to that, but you know, my thought is he probably had quit praying that prayer. But this old prayer of his and his wife's, God's angel shows up years later and says, your prayer's been answered. Anyway, sorry. I don't mean to be emotional. So I hope that's encouraging, you know, on two fronts. One, look for these connections. But two, you know, God's timetable is not our timetable. So, okay, let me let me flip over to this. Well, tell you what, let me do one other thing here. Some of you know Rich Keshen, Rich and Nancy Keshen, longtime members of Redeemer. Rich sent me something this week, kind of out of the blue, and this is a little talk that was given by a University of Virginia econ professor. Interestingly, it's a professor that both Nancy and their son Christopher had. It's kind of interesting that they both had the same professor over many years different. So, but the title here is Being Open About My Faith Without Turning People Off. And I found this so encouraging because I'll just give it to you, ask you not to read it at this moment, but no matter what, you know, this is written from a teacher standpoint, but no matter what standpoint you're coming at, what your work environment is, I think you can get something out of this. And I won't spend a lot, but I'll simply encourage you to read that because I think you'll find it encouraging yourself. But it's odd, except in God's sovereignty. This is very weak that we're talking about this subject. Rich Keshen sent this over and says, hey, I think you might enjoy this. And so let me switch over to this side of the framework here and drop in some ideas as well from this chapter. And what he says here is business, and I would say work, but he's thinking business in particular. Business, he says, can be a means of and the first thing he mentions is church planting. And I'll just list these again, and we'll spend probably the last few minutes talking about this. Societal service. Community building. Grappling, I like this, grappling with the powers. If you haven't read the chapter, I would encourage you to kind of keep this framework in front of you as you read it. But whether you read it or not, what do you think about as you think about business as a possible means of church planting or societal. We touched on some of this earlier in the conversation here, some of the comments some of you made. Church planting, societal service, community building, grappling with the powers. Let's start with that last one. What do you think he has in mind there?
He's speaking about spiritual powers, darkness, and light.
And so I think what he's pursuing, a lot of reasoning he's pursuing is business done well in this sense, can push back. You know, I mean, issues of social justice that we talked about, issues of inhumane labor conditions. You know, we can push back, I think, as believers on that through business. Thoughts on any of those? I know we're getting kind of late. We're not out of time, but I am sensitive to the clock.
I think it relates to what TC said earlier about people being oppressed when Christianity is not present then. On this side, just that, you know, we can do that on a global basis and not merely an individual basis, you know, through business to try and change the culture, to try and change paradigms.
Historically, you see it in schools and hospitals and good works throughout the world that Christians have carried those good works and their businesses, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look to education, there's most of our Ivy League universities started out as Christian institutions. And when Christians go into other societies, they teach and they take health care and do good things. Clean water, the conditions improve when Christianity comes in. So I think we do it pretty automatically. I mean, name the hospitals around here. Lots of them have names of Baptist, Presbyterian, you know.
Yeah.
I think this is true more and more in that I think the issues, the ethical issues at work now become more and more in play because we have a culture that is becoming less and less
Well, this is the point, I think, Ralph.
Right, right. And so I think there are, you know, I said we have a group of students that from the business school that meet once a week as a Christian group. And the and they phrase questions out of their internships that I'm stunned. I mean, it's good that they're raising them, but I think they're a little bit surprised that these are even issues in business because they wouldn't expect to be seeing them. And it's kind of like, why would, you know, so it's this issue of the powers of darkness becoming more and more pervasive wherever they go, whatever job, whatever place it is when they do internships, and how they are stunned at how immoral. So why should we be stunned when things hit the front page of the newspaper?
And, you know, I don't have to tell you that higher educators don't like to talk about issues of morality. I remember when Nathan Hatch came as president of Wake Forest, and he made comments to the effect of, he used the term moral formation. And I can tell you, that set off a firestorm on the campus. And he backed away from using that term, though I don't think he's backed away from his thinking and philosophy on that. But, you know, higher educators don't like to talk about morality. The neat thing to me, and let me go down a rabbit trail for just a moment. I've gotten interested, and I mentioned this to you before, in the whole area of professional education. And there I'm talking about law, medicine, engineering, accounting, my area. From a believer standpoint, one of the nice things about that area is you have to open the door for issues of morality. Now, we still don't like to do that, and we don't do it well. There's a 10-year field study that the Carnegie Foundation did, and that's not a bunch of believers. That's just people who think deeply about education. And you know, their argument is if you're really educating for a profession, you have to deal with issues of morality. Because you say, as a professional, not only am I competent to do my work, but I'm going to do my work with integrity. I mean, that's the basic social contract that a professional has. And so the nice thing about that is it allows you to rub right up against really important issues. It forces you to kind of rub up against those issues. So, anyway.
Do you think that flows out of an enlightenment mindset where just pure rational thought will get you there to work with God?
Partly. But I think partly it's darkened. I mean, I think it's fallen human beings who don't want it. But yeah, and that's all bound up together.
Yeah.
Other thoughts? I'm giving a talk Tuesday to a bunch of educators in Albuquerque. By the way, you can pray for me this week on this topic. Not this topic, but on the importance of the moral formation piece of professional education. Mm-hmm. Bunch of accounting educators. you know, you can ask me next week how that went. I'm anxious to see. And I'm not going to drill down into the things we're talking about here, but just this whole idea of moral formation, when you put that on the table, you're going to get some pushback.
My question is, I went to grad school. We didn't have what would you call ethics classes.
Sorry.
I mean, it was kind of part of the world. But now every major grad school has ethics classes. We have to take continuing education, and every year there's part of it. You know, there's the ethics module. And I'm thinking, I'm 52 years old. If I don't get it by the time I'm 14,
Well. Okay, let me answer that.
Tell me what your rules are, and we'll send you to jail if you do this.
Let me answer it in two quick ways. One, my field and Craig's field. Craig's an engineering scientist. But anyway, you're an engineer. My field and Craig's field are both a little different than the other professions because the professional education starts at the undergraduate level in engineering and in accounting. You got an engineering background as well. Okay, so. So there is, empirically, there is intellectual formation occurring in that age range that means we can have an impact on. I mean, there's good empirical evidence that suggests that the right kind of teaching can actually lead to intellectual formation consistent with moral decision making. So I would agree with you, and that's why I would argue, and Tom, we've had this argument over at Wake Forest, that there is something substantively different about undergraduate education and graduate education, because you're still dealing with intellectual formation when you're talking about 18 to 22-year-olds. You're not dealing with that when you're talking about a 30 or 40 year. So, but I still think you're right. Even though there is a lot of stuff that's already kind of hardwired, I still think it would be important to kind of raise those issues.
I've always, there aren't many Catholic things I've latched onto.
Yes.
But, you know, the Jesuit belief, they give me a child for the first 7 years of his life, and he's, you know, and he's mine forever. It's a big paraphrase, but, you know, it's like, those are the years when the morality is created.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it's 10 years. I don't know. But it's not 25. Sorry. And I would agree with you, undergrad, you know, you can still build people.
Yeah. Well, I would say, this is a whole different conversation, but I would say that, you can't push me too far on this because of the time, but good morality, if I can use that term, is good economics as well, or can be, especially, I'm thinking about, if you read this chapter, you saw the example of the car dealer, and I've had conversations with Don Flo, the CEO of the Flo Motors. Whether or not you've had good experiences with Flo Motors, okay, let's leave that aside. I know Don has thought very seriously about how to make his business a, in fact, I thought about having him come in and just share. And he's thought deeply about what does it mean to have a business that's structured on kingdom principles, whether my employees are believers or not. What does it mean to honor them? What does it mean to honor our customers? And you saw the example in this chapter, if you read it, of the dealer. And that might have been Don Flo in disguise, I don't know, who said, you know, when I do analysis on, under the old model of going in and dickering over a deal, guess who gets hurt? Guess what kind of customer gets hurt in that model? Well, it's those who can least afford to be hurt. And it's kind of the power brokers that don't mind coming in and wrestling down a good deal. You know? So he said that changed his whole way of thinking about, you know, the prices he offers. Now, I don't know that that was Flo, but it struck me that it could have been. Well, I'm out of time. There were a couple of hands. Ian Quick?
Yes.
I don't think, Dennis.
Yeah, it's just a real quick comment on Cliff or what that, if it isn't late. And I think if it is late, you know, I feel very hopeful. You know, one of the greatest reasons that I see that it isn't late is because of God's promises. When Christ says, you know, I will build my church in the gates of hell, you know, are not going to prevail against him. You know, he really means that. So you know, we're advancing forward, and, you know, we're encouraging people, and people are getting saved and so forth. So it's not late at all.
All right, I've got to stop. Father, we praise you. You called us into this kingdom work. You placed us where you placed us, wherever that is. And I just pray that you give us your spirit to be sensitive, to look for opportunities, whether in work or at work, to present the good news of your kingdom, the good news of your Son. I love the way TC described that. Just pray that you give us your spirit to boldly go into these conversations that you called us to. We ask this in your lovely Son's name.
Amen.
All right. See you next week. And the chapter will be chapter 6. Tom, you probably know who I'm talking about.
I do.
Hey, guys, you too.
Well, don't tell him I was using him as a
plug. Not at all.
I have a phone.
So
Beverly, you were traveling, weren't you?